Hello, friends, and welcome to Backstory.
I'm your host, Alex Roberts.
Today is the third anniversary of Backstory. That's right, I've been doing this for 3 years, and it's still fun, it's still cool, and I've decided to do something that I think is a little silly, and I feel a little silly doing it, but it has been requested. Today, I am going to be the subject of an interview. My kind producer, Alex Sisk, is going to interview me, and we're going to talk about the show and what it's meant to me and my process. And we're also going to talk a little bit about some games that I'm working on. We'll see how I do on the other side of the microphone. Let's jump right in.
The first episode of Cruel Alex Thesis.
Oh yeah, our extremely short-lived Evangelion podcast. Our never aired Evangelion podcast. Oh my gosh, I should have saved that because then that could be secret archive content.
You're right.
The one episode of the unlaunched anime podcast that we did.
Yeah, when I was still struggling to get the characters together in my head.
Yeah.
Getting everybody's names down. I mean, that did take the entire run of the show.
Yeah, which is kind of wild.
But it was particularly,
because they all have different color hair, so yeah. That's how you know.
Yeah. Sometimes I think it would be fun, I don't know, to revisit that idea.
I think it would be fun. I mean, I liked just like the concept of like it being completely new to you. But because I was so interested in what it would be like for an adult to watch that show, because it made such like, not perfect sense, but like everything that's deeply horribly wrong with it was able to sort of pass through me as a child. I was the same age as the children being traumatized and hypersexualized. And I was like, this all tracks.
Yeah.
But then as an adult being like, I guess other adults made this, and that's like a big sort of concern.
Yeah, it's a little uncomfortable. And I definitely felt that pretty strongly. I think that if we were to go back, even though the series isn't as fresh in my head as it was,
yeah,
I think it would still be pretty interesting.
Well, and I wonder too if like, because I don't know if you've heard, but Evangelion is coming to Netflix, like American Netflix. Yeah, so I guess a lot of people are going to watch that. Like, I mean, it's already, a lot of people have watched it, but it's going to have this, I don't know, like kind of mainstream
resurgence.
Yeah. Resurgence, I guess, which makes sense because it has this like resurgence currently as a meme.
Yes.
But the actual show, the primary text, rather than just like the various covers of that very good theme song.
That was basically how I was introduced to the show. I would just find covers of it and send them to you.
And be like, is this Evangelion? I'm like, yes. Is this Evangelion? Yes.
Exactly, yeah. Well, speaking of podcasts, why don't we talk about a podcast that actually exists?
And that we actually do together.
Yeah, that's right. I am the producer of Backstory, and you are obviously the host and creator.
Yeah, it's me, Alex Roberts. I'm Alex from the computer.
Yeah, that's you.
Yeah, it's been really fun making this show with you. I forget sometimes that like some people actually prefer to do the work that's in the background and not be like the face of things, but to still contribute. Yeah, that's really cool to me, and that works out great for those of us who just kind of want to be the face and have no substance whatsoever.
I'm sure you have some substance somewhere.
I still do, you know, the research and finding people, meeting people, getting in touch with them and organizing all of that stuff. But you do some very, very important polishing that is so important. And something that I actually hear a lot from my guests is that they're really happy with how they sound. And they're like surprised to hear themselves and be like, oh, wow, I actually like, I don't know, people are very nervous to hear themselves. And then they listen to this show at least and they feel at ease. So I think a lot of it is just that you know, people are generally kind of nervous and it's not as bad as they think it's going to be. But also I think you do some particular work to like, you know, in terms of what you edit out and what you leave in to present people in the best light.
Well, thanks. I do try.
Yeah. What's it been like working on this show? Like being the editor and producer?
I really enjoy the work. I wasn't sure if it would work out, but it has. And honestly, I love doing it. And I think it's always fascinating to hear what different people have to say about this thing that I'm sort of interested in. When I was at Metatopia for the first time in November, I was, I don't know, really proud and happy every time I met someone who had been on the show.
Oh, yeah. Because, that's yeah. Right. That's so odd because you're like, I've heard lots.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it was great meeting Daniel Kwan and DC. And I don't know if I met any other guests while I was there. I saw Jackson Tegu, like, from afar.
Oh, that's such a shame. You two should have met because you would get along like a house on fire. The two of you. I would be very amused.
I would like that. Maybe next year.
But Daniel and DC were both wonderful guests.
Yeah, they were.
And Daniel is extremely fun and just like a very kind of high energy guy, which I think comes through in his interview. But like, I don't know, maybe he's as extroverted as I am or something, because you meet him in the con environment and he's just like, oh my gosh, oh my gosh, oh my gosh, this person, this thing, this game, this event, this talk, yay. It's very good to meet someone else who has that energy that I also have, and we can be matched.
Yeah, you're actually right. You do both have this relentless positivity.
That was also, I think, so Daniel's from Toronto, and I think he hadn't been to the States very many times, as where I just go to so many conventions and things like that, that I've spent a lot of time there, but I still am yet to be surprised by some things. And there's still some things that the differences that just really stand out to me. And they were perfectly encapsulated when Daniel Kwan ran up to me outside the hotel holding something that kind of looked like a personal pan pizza box, but he held up the box and said, "Look at this quesadilla." I was like, yeah, that's how big food is here. Food is really big.
It's true.
So, yeah, I feel very lucky that I get to meet so many people in person before I interview them, because I know that's not usually how it works. And there have been a few people that I've just been so excited to have on that I'm like, okay, I can't wait until I meet them in person. I'm just going to have them on. Or Abel is a good example. I had them on and was just like, okay, we need to just like talk for a little bit and just hope that we kind of have a good back and forth banter. And then, because I just need to talk to you about things and I don't care if we actually get a chance to meet in person, because it works so much better. And I get so much more out of guests when I've already had a conversation with them somewhere. Like, I think in a perfect world, I would interview people twice, you know, like I would talk to them for an hour and then I would sit down with them later and get another hour out of them and probably mostly just use that second hour in the podcast, but just have that kind of familiarity built up and comfort, because it's the weird thing with an interview show. Like, I think when it comes to most podcasts, people don't necessarily listen to them for the subject or for the format. It really is about how the hosts interact with each other. People just want to hear people who have like a good dynamic. And so with an interview show, you kind of don't 100% know. And I'm mostly choosing people who I think are doing unique and important work in the game space and in role-playing games specifically. And so I have to kind of balance that with wanting to make like an entertaining, I don't know about entertaining, but like engaging episode for the listeners. Like I want it to be valuable to the listeners, but also I am kind of thinking like, you know, I can't just have fun, cool people on. Like, there's lots of people that are just doing something that is so important or have done stuff that is so important and influential that I feel the need to bring them on and then be like, cool, we will just make this fun and engaging and see what that dynamic is going to be like.
That does actually kind of go into a question I wanted to ask you, because I know you do meet a lot of, and apparently most of, the people you interview, you know, before you interview them. And so is it just having a conversation with them? Do you make certain decisions about how you're going to interact with them? Like, if you're going to affect some kind of objectivity, or maybe if you know one person better than another person and you're interviewing them both, would you approach them differently? Like, maybe dial back how personal you get with someone you know better, or maybe ask different kinds of questions to someone you don't know as well?
Oh, I think definitely, and probably not intentionally, but I definitely treat different guests very differently. It might be a better show, or the show might serve as a better kind of archive of interesting things in the game scene if I dialed back how personal I am and like how candid I am with guests who I know very well. But at the same time, I know that that's fun. Like, that's entertaining. Like, it just goes back to that balance between like it being a sort of, I don't know if it's an academically good show or like if it's, you know, an important historical record or whatever, but there is sort of talking about important stuff versus being entertaining. Ideally I can do both, but I think when I have people who I know very well on, or who I'm really close to on, who tend to go more in the entertaining side, just because that's how it's going to sound. As where when I have people I don't know very well on, I think I just kind of have to lean more on just kind of bringing out what they're doing, asking them about their projects, and the questions are probably a lot less personal. So I don't know if that's a better or worse show, but it's a different show, right? Like, if you listen to, I don't know, if you listen to my episode with Jose Zagal, I had met him a couple of times. Jose is really lovely, but we are not like close friends, right? We haven't like spent a ton of time together. So that show, I think, ends up being very much about his work. And that's great because he's done great work and a lot of academic work. So I had a lot to research, which is wonderful. So we had a ton to talk about. And I could easily do 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 more episodes with Jose and continue to just talk about his research more. But, you know, but if someone who was really close to Jose could do a different episode with him and talk about completely different things in a completely different way, and it would be like totally different episode, you know, and then you compare that with, I don't know, like say an interview with like, I don't know, maybe one of the early ones with like Lizzie Stark or Jason Morningstar, people who I was just like pals with. So I felt really comfortable having them on. I still did tons of research. I still, you know, read Lizzie's first book, you know, cover to cover before that interview, but you can hear some kind of like, I don't know, comfort or coziness there just because we're pals and have like, you know, stayed up till 2 a.m. on the last night of a con together and other such bonding activities.
What kind of research do you do? Is it just about, you know, their work and stuff, I suppose, but what kinds of resources do you like to look at when you prepare to interview someone? I maybe should have asked this before I interviewed you.
Well, it's actually very funny how different it is for different people. Lizzie is actually probably the only person who I have specifically gone out, bought a book that they wrote and read it cover to cover. But I'm very lucky right now that I happen to have access to a university library. So I am able to read scholarly publications that people have put out. A surprising number of like scholarly work is just like out there, like, you know, is under open access. So if I can get at that, that's always really helpful. And sometimes if my guest is an academic, I might ask them to send over some work that they've done. So for example, when I interviewed Jessica Hammer, she has put out a ton of stuff, most of it games related and some of it role-playing game related. And so I was able to just, you know, look her up as author or co-author on on papers, on academic papers, and then read the stuff that I could get access to. And probably I could have asked her if there was anything I didn't have access to, and maybe she could have connected me with it. But with any of my academic guests, I cannot read everything they've ever written. So I tend to just kind of pick out one or two things that I think are going to be interesting, one or two or three or four or five, depends. And then I'll kind of focus on those. So I may ask people for stuff, right? Like I had Brody Atwater on. I knew that they had done a master's thesis on LARP debrief. So I just said like, hey, send me that. So I could read it, you know, in like a little Word document or whatever they had it in at the time, because it was freshly written at that point. So yeah, I do get scholarly articles whenever possible. It's really nice to be able to dig into that stuff, especially because that stuff is out there, but it's not necessarily accessible, like I guess culturally accessible, right? Like academic stuff isn't written in an accessible way. And so that's kind of a cool thing to be able to talk about on a podcast, so that we can turn the findings from that into a conversation that is then very digestible to a much, much broader audience than a research paper might be. So yeah, scholarly stuff, if they've just written lay stuff, like, you know, on their blog, on somebody else's blog, just out there on the internet, I love reading that. The best thing is if I have recently played their games, which is more often than you would think, right? Because very often if I get excited to have someone on, it's because I recently played a game that they made and it was really good. So that's actually the best thing, is when I have recently played a game that they made. If I haven't, then I'll at least try to find and read a few of their games and go through them. And then for some people, like, I read their Twitter, you know, or like just go through whatever they have out there online that they have put out there, you know, or I watch some of the actual plays that they've been on. I really like listening to other interviews that they've done, because then I can make sure not to ask them the same questions that they've been asked in other interviews, because they get so sick of that. And I get to ask them different stuff. When I had, I had Graham Walmsley on, and it was right before his Kickstarter for Cthulhu Dark. And so we were talking about, like, I don't know, disco and sauce recipes or something. And I said, oh, Graham, should we talk about your Kickstarter? And he just said, like, oh, I'd really rather not if we don't have to. And he's like, oh, yeah, no, let's just talk about something else instead. So we talked about, you know, improv and something. So it's nice to be able to figure out what people are excited to talk about, especially if they don't often get a chance to talk about it. So yeah, listening to other interviews or other just stuff that they've put out there. Yeah, kind of just like ask them for what they have, Google the name, and then who knows where that will take me. Yeah.
Yeah, that really makes a lot of sense. You'd have to tailor it to the person and the kind of work they put out, the kind of things they've done.
Yeah, exactly. Because, like, you know, a Twitter thread that starts a really cool conversation is just as, you know, is just as good fodder for an interview as a peer-reviewed paper in an academic journal that's very prestigious, right? Like, the important thing is that they said it and they can talk about it and speak to it more. So yeah, that's what matters. That's the fun stuff.
So when you are meeting people and, you know, inviting people onto the show, you're saying usually it's because you've played something that they've done and you're excited about it. Is there any other part about that process, or who you talk to, or who you would want to talk to, that ever goes into these decisions?
Yeah, definitely. I have been very conscious from the start about trying to prioritize people who are doing stuff that is new, and trying to prioritize people of color, people with disabilities, women and non-binary folks, queers, obviously. A lot of it is just, are they doing something that's different? I really do try to prioritize guests that are from marginalized communities. And I really like having people on who I guess might be called emerging artists in other communities. Like, that's my favorite, is when people who don't have a ton of publishing credits to their name, but they're just in talking to them, they have a different perspective on things, or they're doing something that feels really new, or they're adding a lot to other people's projects, or doing things that, you know, maybe people don't see their names on it. That's really fun when I get to do. And what I try to do is balance that with people who are more established and can speak to really influential work that they've done, right? So if I have, you know, so I was just scrolling back through early backstory guests to say, like, oh, someone who's like not as big, or like, you know, an emerging artist, but a lot of those people are actually like very big now.
Yeah. It's a backstory bump.
I think it's more like me catching the wave at the right moment. Also, you know what? I don't want to name anyone as an emerging artist, because that kind of sounds like you're not very successful.
I just like interviewing people who aren't successful, like this guy.
Like, yeah, exactly. So, you know, I might have someone who is not as well known on and feel like, oh, that's great. I really get to like expose their work to an audience that I have. And then, you know, maybe next week I'll have someone on that, you know, made some game that is super popular and influential and everyone knows, so that I can provide that audience with whatever that person knows. Like, I'm thinking of when I had John Harper on, and he was like we talked about design a bit, but he was also just telling these weird stories of like the, I don't know, like early 2000s independent role-playing game publishing scene, and like weird stuff that people were doing at that time. And like, that was just very entertaining. And that's like a very precious piece of oral history. And it's funny to think of it that way, because really not that long ago, but games has such a short memory that, I don't know, I think like sort of preserving those kinds of things in amber is very important. So I don't necessarily have the most cutting edge new sort of people on all the time. I like to have that balance as much as possible.
I do always find it interesting when you interview people who have been, you know, in games longer than I have, which, you know, isn't really that long. I guess like 10 years now. Well, actually probably less, because you're the one who got me into RPGs, basically. When you have people who've been in games for a very long time, and they have very interesting stories about what was in vogue, how it's different from what's in vogue now, why maybe that was, and what changed, I find that very interesting, because it's often something people don't write about. And often the best way to find out about some odd little detail is just talk to someone who experienced it.
Yes. Oh my gosh. Okay. So something I'm really into right now is extremely biased oral histories. One of my favorite podcasts is called Making Gay History. You should look it up. It's the best podcast. Very inspirational for me as a researcher and interviewer. Like, the guy who produces it is just amazing. And so he has this archive of interviews that he did to put together a book that came out, I think, in the 90s, called Making Gay History. And so the interviews that he did were just like tapes that were part of the research project. But now he has all these interviews, like, with people who in many cases are no longer with us, and who were there at like the beginning of the North American gay rights movement. So like people who were born at the start of the 20th century in many cases. And so, you know, he's got these interviews with like Marsha P. Johnson and Sylvia Rivera, and like, yeah, just anyway. So he'll present the interview and be like, this is what this person said, right? That has value. And sometimes he'll have, you know, three people on in a row who are all talking about the same event, and they all describe it completely differently, right? So they're talking about like the founding of, you know, the Mattachine Society or One or, you know, or whatever, or they're talking about Stonewall riots, and they're all saying, oh, you know, people say that this happened. That didn't happen. It was like this. But then literally the next episode is with someone who's also there, and they have a totally different story. And like, that's good. That's what history is. Like, that doesn't, you know. And so I don't think the interviews that I'm doing are as unbelievably important and like worth preserving forever as as the stuff on Making Gay History, but I do have this desire to have people talk about not just their designs, but also like what is happening right now and their relationships to other people and where they are and what they're doing and why and what's influencing their work and what allows them to do their work and what prevents them. And that's like a delicate thing to do, but I like it. I enjoy it.
It's very interesting stuff. I was going to ask if you had any particular memories that stand out, and I'm a little apprehensive about asking about it now because I'm realizing it might seem like I'm asking about who your favorite guests were, which wouldn't really be fair to you or to your guests.
This, finish your question.
Well, that's what I'm trying to decide. Should I even ask the question?
This is so hard. I find it hard to talk about the show sometimes because there are episodes that I'm really, really, really proud of, that I love, that I'm like, yeah, that I just feel went really well, that I opened up the right doors and they walked through them so gracefully and beautifully. And there are episodes that I'm not as proud of. Like there's episodes that like I don't feel as good about. But it's really hard to talk about that because that's not about the guest. That's not about, you know, oh, I shouldn't have had that person or that person wasn't a very good subject. It's all, everything is my fault. Like it really just is about the interview and, you know, we should have talked about this instead of that, or it didn't go in this interesting direction or, you know, we, whatever. I just didn't open the right doors. Right. Or I talk too much about myself as I do from time to time. So that is disappointing because I know that if I got into the details of that and actually talked about that, that like people would think like former guests would be like, oh, is she talking about my episode or was I a bad guest or whatever? And it really is never about that. So I do definitely have like episodes that I think are just like absolute top tier that I really love, but I have to sort of refrain from talking about the show that way because it's not about favorite guests at all.
That makes total sense. And is why I was hesitating to even ask. Can I ask you about your thoughts about web presence?
Yeah, definitely. That is something that I think about all the time. I was actually like, as a rule, I don't look at the numbers associated with the show. Like I avoid looking at, you know, how many downloads and how many listens and all that kind of analytic stuff. Like I just don't look at it because I know that I could, because then I'll start thinking about like, oh, should those numbers be higher? Why were they lower at this episode versus that episode? Or, you know, should they be increasing over time? And that's a weird kind of feeling to get into. And I know that there are things that I could be doing to like promote the show more, but I don't know. I don't know. It's not fun. And I really want the show to be fun and to like be an expression of something that I'm really enjoying. So I don't really do as much to promote the show as I could, besides just like being on the internet, which I have been, and mentioning as I do that I have this thing that people can listen to if they want to. And even then I'm not as online as I used to be, like significantly so.
I understand that you want the show to be, you know, expressive more than a cynical way to promote something, yourself or your work, or even for profit. You want it to have its own merits. And I totally understand then not wanting to stress about numbers. That makes sense. I'm looking at your Twitter right now. Yeah, you're mostly tweeting about the show, but it's just, you know, your Twitter. Maybe I'm just too close to the subject in this case.
Yeah, no kidding. Oh yeah, listeners, Alex and I had been friends for like many years.
Yeah,
all through university. So like 10 years, probably.
Yeah, 10 years.
Yeah, and like very close friends, BFFs.
The interview is now just going to be you saying that looped for 45 minutes.
The techno remix.
The techno remix. Best friends. Is your own web presence like something that you feel you want to cultivate and grow, or is it just the organic movement of yourself on the internet?
It has been, but now I've decided to start a Patreon, and that is a weird decision for me because it's the opportunity to spend a lot more of my time doing design, like making art. And yeah, you know, I haven't had a full-time job for like 2 years. I've just been doing game stuff. I've just been freelancing. And, you know, I live very simply, and so I can kind of do that. But I found that increasingly I am doing, you know, admin stuff or very often like marketing for game companies. And, you know, I left marketing for games. And so if I just end up doing marketing work all the time, it's kind of like, this is not my intention. This is not kind of what I meant to do. And you know, I also have an academic career, hopefully, that I'm trying to sort of get started. So I really like the idea of just being able to make all these games that is difficult to be able to devote the time to. And not just games, but also writing. You know, I really, really love being able to write for other people's games or write essays and game criticism. You know, the things that I've written for Waypoint and for Zeal, like, I'm so proud of that work. And right now, I just don't have the time to devote to it. But the thing about being on Patreon is that then, like, people are supporting your work, but they're supporting you. And so I don't know if that will change how I am able to, like, exist online. Like, right now, I'm really kind to myself, not my entire self. I don't put all parts of me out there, but I also don't, I try not to put anything out there that isn't me. But I wonder, like, I love the idea of having this little group of people who are excited about stuff that I do, right? Excited about my ideas and my work, who can support me financially, but also who can just be there when I have some thoughts, you know, or have something half finished and that I can throw it out there to and that they can respond to. That's really exciting. And so it's just a matter of figuring out how can that relationship be a healthy one? How can that be a positive, nurturing thing for both parties and not one where either I am exploiting them or they are exploiting me? Because it can go either way. And very often it's both in that kind of thing. So I want to dive into it and I want to figure it out because it's such a wonderful opportunity for me to, you know, for me to make my game about, I don't know, make my game about balloon fetishists and their attempts to be communal online, to finish Little Town, you know, which is a game I'm co-designing that's about cute little animals who wanna live together harmoniously. Similar themes, actually. You know, or make my apocalypse world hack that is just distant parent and overachieving child. There's only two playbooks in the game. We'll figure out what the title is. You know, or to write about recipes as game texts, you know, or to write about how to get into LARPing. This thing that people keep emailing me about all the time, and I am sometimes helpful and sometimes not. I would love to be able to say, I am going to sit down and really write a how-to guide that is going to be genuinely useful for people rather than just kind of giving haphazard recommendations via email. There's just that kind of stuff that I would really like to be able to put out there and to have an audience who I know will enjoy it and also to be like supported in it. Because when I'm freelancing, there's only so much free time and saying yes to one thing means saying no to other things. And I kind of have to be careful about how I spend my energy, right? So I'm very, very hopeful. Yeah, if you care about stuff that I make, come join me on this journey. We'll figure out if we can be mutually helpful to each other.
I really like the idea of these kinds of communities where we can, almost defying expectations of support, wherein our society expects us to be self-sufficient in this really specific way but also completely reliant on a particular class for that self-sufficiency. And we can form communities where we support each other, thanks to the, well, I guess right now it's because of the internet, admittedly through companies that are like trying to exploit this for profit, but
but an interesting side effect.
Yeah, there's this niche where people with few other options can build communities and find, you know, other people in this niche, and they don't actually have to be close to each other to support each other. It's very advantageous for now.
Yeah, and I think about stuff that people like Kira Magron is doing. I had her on the show a couple of years ago, and what she's been doing on Patreon is really awesome. You know, Kira has talked very publicly about, living with chronic pain and how that affects what she can do. And the fact that, you know, she has this regular stream of income from people who are just ready to support what she is up to. And she puts a lot of really interesting game design thoughts, cultural criticism, and design out there in the world. And people just see that as valuable, and it doesn't matter whether or not she can do it in a particular way and with this particular sort of regularity and all those other things that are required, you know, in certain systems. People just see that and they're like, no, that's good. I want that. I want that to exist in the world, and I have the ability to support it. So I would like to see an even greater diversity of models of support, of like material support in games. But right now we have a few and they're pretty cool. So I am excited about that for sure.
Yes. I'm also very excited about what options this can present to all of us. Do you want to talk about any of your games very much at all?
Yeah. Ask me. Okay. Ask me.
Well, StarCrossed, of course, is coming close to its release.
Yes. Oh my gosh. I'm so excited. I keep like resisting watching the little shipping tracker. Like right now, all they're being shipped to the warehouses. And so they're on these like huge freighters in the ocean. And so they're going very, very slowly. They're not very, I was asking Steve Sagetti about it the other day. And he was like, yeah, they're not very dynamic. You know, it's not like birding where they could just fly away at any moment. They kind of just go where they're going, and it's not very exciting. But they will be on shore soon, and then they will be shipped out to the people who will be excited to receive them. And they'll be going out to game stores. Like, oh gosh, I want it to be happening now. I'm getting very impatient. This close to release.
Well, it is close at least. So.
And it drove me nuts that we were, that, you know, our initial plan was to have them shipped out in December, and stuff happens, life happens. There was just a little bit of a delay because of some things that we wanted to change after the proof came in, and it's all for the best because we want it, you know, to be perfect, and well, not perfect, but the best it can be. And so, you know, that meant we got delayed by a month, and so things are being shipped out. And I was so like torn up about this, and you know, having to tell our Kickstarter backers that, okay, well, you know, it's going to be a little bit late. It's going to be a month late. And I know that it's going to be really disappointing to people. And like, nobody cared as much as I did. Everyone was like, oh, my Kickstarter is going to be only a month late. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, exactly.
So everyone was very kind about that, which I was very glad of. So I'm accepting it. I'm moving on.
You're also publishing For the Queen with Evil Hat.
Yes, that's right. Which is funny because I was kind of working on For the Queen in the very, very final stages of getting the final text for StarCrossed finished up. And it was this thing that kind of came to me in a dream and was just kind of my, like, I don't know, like blowing off steam project, right? Because StarCrossed is almost done. And so it just takes all these tiny little tweaks and tiny little fixes and edits and just the most painful work to me personally. It's not as fun as just, you know, getting big ideas onto the page that are not, you don't know how broken they are yet and that kind of thing. So that was me and For the Queen. I was like, well, this is, you know, this is not like a sellable game. This is will never be a commercial product of any kind. It might not go any farther than just me and my pals playing with it, which to be fair is also what I thought about Starcross. But then I played it at a house con and Sean Nittner of Evil Hat Productions happened to be there. And he was like, hey, cool game. Can we publish it? And they were just happened to be on track to do it very quickly because of just the format of the game. And I spoke with Bully Pulpit about it. I mentioned it to them in a meeting. I was like, oh yeah, I made this game and Evil Hat wants to do it. Do you want to do it? And because Steve and Jason are the absolute sweetest people in the entire universe, Steve was just like, well, honestly, they'll like, we would do it, but we would have to do it like next year after this and after that. Because of course, we at Bully Pulpit Games are working on Fiasco right now, the new version of Fiasco that's going to be card-based in a box and very exciting, very cool. And we're trying to devote all our energy to that. So they were like, yeah, Evil Hat can do it. That's nice. So it worked out really well. And someone advised me to like shop it around further. And I was like, no, I trust Sean. I'll just work with Evil Hat. And that has been a good choice because that has been very positive. And it's been a lot of fun. And I've learned a lot working with two different game companies and seeing how they do things differently. And also the common best practices between them. That's very important to know too. So I think as I go on making games and doing stuff and maybe someday self-publishing, although I don't know. I don't know how anyone does that. That is so hard. It's bonkers. There's just so much to it. Like making Starcross, especially because I'm also like in Bully Pulpit, right? I'm their production coordinator. And so I got to see things from like the designer perspective, but then I'm also in there doing, you know, helping Matt project manage and market and that kind of thing. And there were so many times that I, as the designer, just had to be like, okay, I need to step away from this and you guys need to say how this is going to happen and how that is going to happen. And Steve just, there's so much that Steve just did without me ever seeing it. It was still such a, like a massive project, like such a big part of my 2018. That man, when I think about like just trying to do something like that alone, like I don't know how it's possible. And I hope that it's possible for people to like self-publish because they reach out to other people in the community. That is my hope. And I think that's the case. Because yeah, no, I would go a little bit nuts trying to figure out the whole thing myself, start to finish.
I actually did wonder how you got that just out to a publisher so fast.
It was extremely coincidental. I unintentionally shopped it. Evil Hat just happened to be looking for projects and Sean and I just happened to be at the same table, pretty much. And he enjoyed the game. So yeah, you never know. You never know what's gonna happen. Get your stuff out there, I guess. And I only had it ready because you were there when I first play tested it. It was literally the same day that I wrote the first draft, which was not even a draft. Like it was nothing. It was a pile of index cards. And at that time, a lot of dice and a Jenga tower.
Right. That's right. Yep. I remember that.
Yeah. What a ridiculous idea. What a bad idea. But I got it on the table. So it was literally that day that I got in touch with like you and Angie and David and Sam and said like, hey, do you guys want to play a game I just imagined? And you all said yes. So we got together like 2 days later and play tested it. And then I was able to get rid of the Jenga tower and the dice. And it's only because of that that I had enough momentum on it. Yeah. To just keep playing it with people and keep putting it out there. So like, I don't know. That was just a nice lesson for me, I guess. Especially because Starcross was like, again, not something I ever pictured being a commercial product, but also something that was like in my heart for such a long time and like that I thought about for such a long time. And I didn't think I'd ever make anything else after that. I was like, I just got one game in me. So it's nice to just think like, okay, but if you think of something, like just throw it out there. Just go make it.
Something will happen with it.
Yeah. And maybe something that will happen is, oh, it turns out it's not very good and it goes back in the drawer and whatever, you have another idea. I feel like story games teach you nothing else. They should teach you that ideas are cheap, that ideas just, there's a million of them. And sometimes they're good and sometimes they're bad. Even if they're bad, they can be kind of entertaining and like you can move on.
Sometimes when people are designing, they have an idea and then they have no idea how to mechanize it. But then sometimes people also start from a mechanic and they just don't have the idea behind it or something to you know, give it the kick.
Yeah. And I think that says a lot too about what people are excited about, you know, whether they're excited about settings and then they just go, okay, I would love to play in this setting. I'm familiar enough with this, you know, D12 based skill thing. Okay, sure, fine, whatever, because it's really just about me playing in this either pre-existing setting that I think is so cool, I want to go play around in it, or I imagine this, you know, I came up with this setting that is so cool, I don't care what wheels it, you know, runs on. But then for other people, they get so excited thinking about all the little levers and and math and underlying things. That's what's really exciting to them. And so then whatever has to kind of go on top of that, it's like, sure, whatever. Whatever makes it go. Like, I don't know, it just, the way that people get excited about games and the way that people play games, they reveal so much about themselves in that. I think that's why I like playing games, actually, is just to see what people, to see what people show. Yeah, to see what gets revealed.
I feel like all of the games of yours that I have played are effectively about giving people the tools to tell a story that matters to them in some way or speaks to them in some way. And you give a little bit of guidance, but then mostly it's just our fantastic human capacity to generate narratives and think of conflict and possibilities that fills in everything else.
Oh yeah. And to fill in the blanks. People are so amazing at just filling in the blanks with whatever is interesting to them or scary to them or funny to them in that moment, right? Like think of a tweet or a vine that stops halfway through a word, you know, or just as someone is about to react to something rather than showing the reaction. I love that. Like I love that kind of humor. It's very, very funny. And I think part of the reason that it's funny is because people are actually filling in the blank with the reaction or the response that is funny to them. And they don't even realize that they're doing it, but it just, that loop kind of gets closed based on what, on their sense of humor. And so it's funny, you know, it's, or in a horror movie when you never quite see the monster, you know, like an alien, you know, I'm pretty sure they shot Alien the way they did because that monster looks so bad, but like, it's so scary because you can't see it. And I think that's because people, again, they just fill in the blanks. They just go with whatever is scary to them. There's totally a word for this. McLeod talks about this in Understanding Comics. You know, our ability to see animation and that kind of thing and to read between the panels. Yeah, it's so cool. And I love being able to make or to play games that do that, that give people some blanks to fill in, basically. And then just see as they get to fill it with meaning, like with stuff that is meaningful to them. Very often, that means that they get to tell stories that they don't get to see told elsewhere. And sometimes they're telling stories that they do get to see, and it's the ones that they love. And that's great too. Sure, you know, use the tropes that fill you with delight. But like, I don't see stories, for example, about people who are not really glamorously, conventionally attractive being in love. And so that's always what I like StarCross to be about, you know, or I don't get to see stories that are about love that is genuinely too complicated to really be satisfying, to be a satisfying relationship, not because of external forces or not because it's like forbidden in the Romeo and Juliet sense, but because like it's just not going to work. Like I think that's so interesting, and I never get to see that. Not never, but you know what I mean. And so StarCrossed can also do the Romeo and Juliet, and it can do the happy ending, but I love it when people use it to tell that kind of story, or when I get to use it to tell, because I do still play it from time to time. and now that it's going to be out and in people's hands, I will probably get back into demoing it, which is wonderful.
That is, well, all very exciting. It really is. If you want to talk about this, I know absolutely nothing about your animal game, Animal Village, Little Village.
Oh, Little Town.
Little Town.
Little Town, yay.
Yeah, I just saw that you were playtesting it at Metatopia. I, you know, it was already full. Mm-hmm. So I know absolutely nothing about this. So whatever you're willing to say about this would be very interesting to me personally, and then probably also to listeners, I guess. I don't know.
It doesn't matter. We'll cut this. Let's see. Okay, so the story of Little Town starts with a yoga festival called Bhakti in the Woods that takes place just outside of Ottawa every year. Is run by a very impressive woman named Romelva Porter. So my dear friend and award-winning LARPite, Sean Rusky, he hates it when I introduce him that way, has been running LARPs there for the past couple of years. And he ran Before and After Silence, which is a great game about, it's a completely silent game where everybody gets a card that says, here's what you think is going on, or how you are perceiving the situation. And everyone's card is completely different. And it's again, very much a game about filling in the blanks, because it shows our incredible human capacity to project roles onto people and to think that we know what's going on and to project meaning that fits with our perceptions onto things. So it's brilliant. Yoga people went nuts for it. They love being silent. And he ran Still Life, which is also a mostly silent game about pretending to be a rock that's having an existential crisis. And again, yoga folks really enjoyed it. So he said, you know, come with me and we'll co-facilitate something. We were thinking maybe Here Is My Power Button, which is a great game that needs two facilitators. There's a couple of others we were kind of tossing around. And we really wanted to pick a game that was going to be good for either people who had LARPed once or twice, maybe, right, if they had gone before, or people who, you know, are into embodiment, right, and people who are probably pretty open-minded and do new things and are ready to just, like, try stuff and go for it and be kind of weird, right? Like, you know, it's the yoga and new agey scenes are, like, not my scenes, but there's some very interesting opportunities there in terms of, like, trying new stuff. But at the same time, so much of gaming relies on, like, particular pop culture knowledge, or, like, I don't know, not everything seemed to fit. We didn't want to go with, like, a, you know, kind of traditionally geeky stuff, the themes. So, and we also didn't know how many people were going to be there. So we needed something that was very flexible in terms of player count. So we thought about a bunch, and there was a bunch that could have worked, but we eventually just decided to make our own. And I've had this desire for a very long time to LARP as, like, Sanrio characters. Sanrio is in, like, Hello Kitty, but Hello Kitty is not the only sort of denizen of Sanrio and, like, that world. Like, there's also, like, Caterpie, the little frog, and, like, Gudetama, who's, like, actually a little Eggman, and, like, My Melody, who's a little bunny. So there's, like, this whole cast of, like, really cute little animals, and they just, like, do their thing. And I really like the idea of LARPing as not only just not violence, like, completely nonviolent, but just, like, pastoral and soothing. I was playing a lot of Animal Crossing at the time. So,
yeah, I was actually thinking about that.
Yeah, right? Yeah, so just the idea of just doing very kind of domestic things that are very low-key, and you're being cute and you're being friendly with each other. And so I'd been talking to him about this idea, and he was really thinking about it because he doesn't know Sanrio. He was thinking about it in terms of, like, Wind in the Willows, or Frog and Toad, or, like, Peter Rabbit, and those kinds of, like, kids' stories about cute little animals. And so we found a game called Let's Be Dinosaurs and thought, okay, this is almost perfect. So we were originally just going to run that. But then the more that I read through it, it's by Javier Beltran. The more that I read through it, I was like, oh, this is very, very similar to what I want to do with Little Town. So we, at first we just skinned that game, but then we played around with it a little bit, and if that wasn't quite right. So it's kind of like Dread and Starcrossed, where it just got further and further and further from the source material. So now they're quite dissimilar, but still credit goes to Javier for a really lovely game that gave us a beautiful starting point. So we made this game called Little Town, and it's about cute little animals who live together in a little village, and they have very little problems. These are not big end of the world kinds of things, right? They're not life or death situations, but they're still important things, and they all have to work together to figure out what they're going to do and how they're going to bring themselves to that issue or that conflict or that problem to make it better. And so it's a game about stepping into yourself and, like, bringing what is true about yourself not best, it's not your best self, but like whatever is true about you to a situation to heal it. And it went off really well. I mean, it was still, you know, a first playtest. It wasn't perfect, but it went off really well. And the yoga folks, who were also in some cases LARP folks, they really enjoyed it. So then we brought it to Metatopia. Again, still lots of kinks to be ironed out, I guess, but people really enjoyed it. They told such sweet stories. I ran it at a house con in September, and I love what people become when they play this game. They get so delicate with each other, and they get so considerate and thoughtful and sweet and cute, and they work together and they try to be harmonious. And I just love being able to like induce that. So Little Town is going to be played again, probably this month, because I'm going to another kind of small gathering where I might get to play with it. But this is so, I don't know. For like about a year, I've been going to Quaker meeting and hanging out with the folks, you know, in the Quaker community, the friends. It's pretty cool. And they like to just like do stuff. They like to just like have a storyteller come in, you know, or do a potluck or do whatever. And just that kind of programming. And some of the folks here at the Victoria meeting found out that I make games, and they were like, well, come run a game for us. And so I thought about it, and I thought, okay, well, I'm going to run Little Town, because they wanted something that I made. And so now Little Town is being adapted to be run with a really large group of people, none of whom have ever played a role-playing game before. So it's going through some more changes. but yeah, so this Little Town has been fun because, you know, we just kind of work on it when we can. We live very far apart, and it's only my second time co-designing. I co-made another kind of large group game with Jason Morningstar a few years ago. That's very fun and very cute. But this is just like, it's just a cool trick to turn grown-ups into the cute little animals that are inside their hearts and that they remember from like cartoons and storybooks and that kind of thing from when they were kids. And so you can see people bringing out, you know, Wind in the Willows or Peter Rabbit or Miffy or whatever like cute kids cartoon that they were into as a kid. And, you know, it's just awesome because people remember that when there's a cartoon or comics or whatever about animal friends like that, there's very often like one who is brave, you know, or one who is very shy and very scared, or there's one who's kind of mean, or there's one who's like a big know-it-all, but he's not actually that smart and he gets a lot of things wrong. And so you can be that character and bringing that, like and everyone still loves you and you're still a part of the community, even though you're like, you know, really boastful and full of yourself, or even though you're really clumsy and you get things wrong, doesn't matter. Like you're still part of that and bringing yourself. Anyway, I realize I'm not explaining it very well, and I get so excited when something is new, but yeah, so that's Little Town. Have I explained it well? I really got on.
You've explained it well enough that I really want to play it.
Perfect.
To be perfectly honest, that sounds completely up my alley, as I'm sure you're aware.
Oh yeah, oh my gosh, you would love it. So I'm going to do an artist residency at Mount Kaz, which Backstory listeners will recognize Albert Kong, who I had on the program not too long ago. He and his partner just have a guest bedroom, and periodically they have artists there to hang out for a couple weeks and make stuff and bring it to the community of creative and interesting folks that they have there. So they've invited me. So I'm going to go down there for a couple weeks. I'm going to work on my my LARP about people who love balloons, but I'm definitely going to be also playtesting Little Town some more. And I think that they're going to enjoy it very much. That's my anticipation. So this is the kind of thing that I'll be able to spend more time on if my Patreon blows up and gets very big.
I'm very excited for that.
That would make me very happy.
Yeah. Wow. The balloon fetishist LARP is something that you've always talked about and never really, you know, developed for various reasons. And I'm very excited to hear that you're continuing to work with the idea.
It's, you know, it's kind of ridiculous that I'm going to an artist residency. I think it's, you know, my life is just a series of ridiculous, unexpected, cool things I never thought I'd get to do. And so I'm kind of just giving myself that 2 weeks to actually just like sit down with paper and pens, you know, just markers and stuff, and just get stuff out there and to play test at least little parts of it, like world building. So it's a game that takes place entirely online. And so it's mostly about simulating online communication in like an in-person way. So you have to make your own internet. You have to decide what is on this fictional internet that we're all on. So what's the search engine situation like? Are there any? Do they exist? Do we just have web rings? Are there forums? Is it more like, is it like BBS? Or do we have like image boards? Is there a Twitter equivalent, like something that like is like a microblogging platform? Do people tend to write really long things? How long does it take to download like a 5-minute video? I definitely don't want there to be YouTube or Google in the game. Like there's a few kind of restrictions, but basically I want people to make an internet, figure out what's communication look like here. Because it's a game about people trying to find other people who are like them, right? Balloon fetishists, generally speaking, are not looking, when they go on the internet anyway, from my observations, they are not looking for partners to hook up with. They're looking for other people who have the same thoughts and feelings that they do. They're looking for materials, you know, or advice, right? I've read threads, for example, on forums that are like, I have this kind of balloon, but I find that they pop really easily. Where do you guys order this really good type of balloon? Or anyway, just like really mundane stuff a lot of the time. But then also they go on and share like, here's when I first knew that I was a little bit different and had this about me. What about you folks? What was your like moment of realization? But they also go on and they fight with each other. They get so angry with each other and they have these schisms, you know, like any other online community over whether or not it's okay to pop a balloon or, you know, that kind of thing. But I want to figure out, how do we simulate online communication in a way that is appropriately chaotic, because it can be chaotic, and yet is appropriately slow, because sometimes it's very asynchronous, and is also like unique and interesting and fun to do when you're running around speaking out loud rather than being at a computer. So yeah, I at least want to play test parts of it.
That is very interesting.
Yeah.
I'm so glad that this idea, you know, it keeps coming up.
Mm.
Now it looks like you're developing it more, because you used to joke about this idea for a game that will obviously never be played or published or probably even made. But now you are actually making it.
Yeah. Well, I think about the fact that I've said that about every idea I've ever had. Like, well, obviously this is a ridiculous idea and, you know, no one actually wants to play it. But then whenever I don't listen to that and I make it and I do it, actually people usually enjoy it very much. And that's not to say I've never had a bad idea. I've had lots of terrible ideas that are never going to see the light of day. But like, yeah, like not listening to that voice that says like, oh yeah, you can think this, but you know, obviously it's not actually a good game. Like just ignoring that voice and kind of doing it anyway has served me very well. And so I'm going to try to just keep doing that. Just gonna let that voice say whatever it needs to say and not really drive the bus. Like what's the Simpsons gag where he's like, oh, thanks for telling me, I'll type that up right now on my invisible typewriter.
I believe that was Chief Wiggum.
Thank you. Yes.
We should do Simpsons trivia again sometime.
That would be so fun. It's everywhere. If you come here to Victoria, we'll do it here. To Alex for being a wonderful interviewer, and as always, thank you for listening. If you have thoughts on today's show, please do email me. That's backstorypodcast@gmail.com. You can also reach me on Twitter @backstorycast. Backstory is part of the One Shot Podcast Network. It's hosted by me, Alex Roberts, usually, and always produced by the talented Alex Sisk. You can go to oneshotpodcast.com to hear more great shows like Warda. Warda is an original fantasy actual play podcast created by Ali Grauer and Drew Mirzieski. It's one part Game of Thrones, two parts Downton Abbey, served on the rocks with a twist of Agatha Christie. Discover magic, mystery, and more than a little socio-political commentary along the way. The city holds thousands of stories. What will yours be?
Music for Backstory is provided by Ujiko. The track is called Thinking of You, and you can hear more by searching UJICO on YouTube, SoundCloud, Spotify, or wherever else you get your chill beats.
They just made a really adorable holiday music video called Magical Holiday. You can find it on their YouTube channel. Highly recommended. Anyway, Happy New Year and happy anniversary. Talk to you later, friends.